Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. I'm Padraig Reedy and co-hosting the show with Neil Denny. And this week our guest is philosophy writer Nigel Warburton. And hand over to Neil to introduce Nigel.
Thanks, Padraig. Nigel Warburton is a contemporary philosopher. As well as being a senior lecturer in philosophy at the Open University, he hosts the Philosophy Bites podcast and he teaches a popular course on art and philosophy at Tate Modern. He is the author of many popular introductions to philosophy, including Philosophy of the Basics, Thinking from A to Z, and Free Speech, A Very Short Introduction. We'll be talking about Nigel's latest book tonight, which is A Little History of Philosophy. So, Nigel, welcome to Little Atoms, first of all.
Thanks, I'm delighted to be here.
Let's talk, first of all, about... I'm intrigued as to who this book is aimed at.
Well, the target audience is anybody who's interested in philosophy. And the aim was to write something that was accessible to an intelligent teenager, but not patronising to either a teenager or an adult of any age. So it's aimed at people who want to find out more about philosophy, really. But it shouldn't exclude anybody.
Well, the reason I asked that question is because there's an interesting quote from Peter Cave, someone else who's been on the show before, on the back, which specifically says it should have a splendid appeal for a young audience. But I didn't get the impression in reading it that it was particularly aimed at teenagers or children.
I did try it out on my teenage daughter. She was a very perceptive critic of some uses of language. What I did was I tried to write in a way that doesn't presuppose knowledge, and I used relatively short sentences, a clear vocabulary, avoided technical terms, and explained things as I went along. So it shouldn't be difficult for a teenager. I mean, some people make out philosophy as the most difficult subject in the world, but believe me, compared with theoretical physics, it's a very straightforward subject.
And so,
I think it should be accessible to anybody as a subject. And often philosophers overcomplicate the way they express things, even though the ideas that they're expressing aren't terribly difficult for people to understand. It's more that they're used to talking to each other in a certain style which makes all kinds of assumptions and it doesn't let other people in, so it's a kind of esoteric activity. And it needn't be, because I believe that philosophy arises quite naturally out of the human condition. We ask ourselves these deep questions about why we're here, whether life has a purpose, how we should live, the ultimate nature of reality. Those sorts of questions, how we should live together in society. The fundamental questions, is there a God? That's a pretty basic question almost anybody alive will have asked themselves at some point. And so these questions arise quite naturally out of the human condition. Often, with kids who are sort of six or seven, they're asking some of those questions and making serious stabs at answers and reasoning about those questions. So what I'm trying to do is connect those quite natural questions with the literature of philosophy, which is a fantastic resource. And we've got 2,500 years of Western philosophy. Some of the brightest people to have lived chose to write about philosophy, and some of them are superb writers as well. So we've got this amazing resource to draw on. And I'm trying to give a palatable way of linking the thoughts that somebody might have anyway before they approach philosophical writing with this great literature.
There's 40 short stories about philosophers from the ancient philosophers right up to pretty much the modern day. Let's talk a little bit about when you're setting down, there's obviously a lot more philosophers there have been out there, and how do you go about choosing this, who to include? Let's talk about how you made this selection. Is there any sort of theme, or is it these particular ones?
There are a number of themes, and there are a number of deliberate exclusions. I made a decision quite early on to focus on Western philosophy, partly because it's the philosophy that I knew most about, and I felt it would fit this format well, but partly because I wanted to avoid a kind of tokenism where you put in one Eastern philosopher in a batch of 40 or two, then it looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's far worse than just focusing on a tradition, which is what I've done. In terms of who's in and who's out, I haven't tried to summarise in a short chapter the complete works of any particular philosopher. What I've done is I've chosen one or two key ideas for each philosopher and tried to say enough about them that we can actually engage with the philosophy and stimulate thought. The aim is not to give you a straightforward summary that you just take away and memorise. The point is to prod you into thinking as you're reading, and that's what philosophy is all about, as far as I'm concerned. Challenging ideas, that engagement, not the passive reading of books, but the active reading where you think as you read rather than just let it wash over you. So in terms of who I left out and who's in, some people have commented that I left Heidegger out, Martin Heidegger, which I did for a number of reasons. One, I think his writing is incredibly difficult, and I wouldn't want to steer a beginning philosopher into the thickets of Martin Heidegger's Being and Time. I've got a personal aversion to him he was a committed Nazi, and I do think there are connections between some of his philosophical ideas and his Nazism. And I just think the people who write about Heidegger often adopt the impenetrable style themselves. It's very difficult not to get caught up in that. I do talk about another famously difficult philosopher, Hegel, and I try to pick an idea, talk about how history unfolds in his view, and give a summary of that and try and get to grips with that. And I found that pretty difficult. And obviously there's a risk with any summary that you don't do justice to the thinker. So Heidegger's an obvious admission anyway. There's another anti-Semite I left out. not for that reason, but an analytic philosopher, so-called Frege, Gottlob Frege, who most analytic philosophers think is a very, very significant philosopher of language. And I left him out because I didn't feel that he was in the top 40, basically. I didn't feel that I could make an interesting chapter out of his philosophy. I probably could have included him if I'd gone to 50, but 40 didn't fit in. But for me, the one that I would most like to have put in retrospect, I think, was Thomas Paine, who I think is a fascinating character. The great Republican thinker who very clearly identified what's wrong with a monarchy, and you know, the idea that somebody would inherit the qualities necessarily that would make them a good ruler. It's actually quite poignant for today as well, that if you read his work on common sense and so on, it is a really interesting book, and I think he's a really interesting thinker with an interesting life as well, and I could easily have included him, and I think I probably should have done in retrospect. But I don't know who I left out.
Okay, well, let's move on to who's in. I think a lot of our listeners would self-identify as sceptics, which is something you address in the book. Could you tell us something the origins of that philosophical notion and the precepts of that?
Well, there's an ancient Greek school of scepticism, which is fortunate in having an extreme case of scepticism as somebody who lived their life almost like one of those Indian gurus who purported not to take anything at all on trust. There's a theme that runs through the book, which is about the relationship between philosophy and life. And I begin with Socrates and end with Peter Singer, both of whom didn't just, or don't in Peter Singer's case because he's still alive, don't just reason in an ivory tower, but they engage in a public forum, literally in Socrates' case, and take risks and gain enemies. And their philosophy actually, in Peter Singer's case, is that he's a passionate vegetarian. He's committed to greater fairness in terms of poverty, across global poverty, exposure to diseases and so on. So he's completely committed as a philosopher. He's not an abstract ivory tower sort of philosopher. There's that theme going through there. But the sceptics, the early sceptics, were almost like Monty Python figures. Pyrrho allegedly lived his life in such a way that if somebody said, look, eat your meal, that's going to nourish you, he's saying, well, how do you know it's going to nourish you? How do you know it's not poison? It might be poison. It might actually make me really ill. Or he'd walk towards the edge of a cliff, and a normal person, as their toes just reached the lip of the cliff, would get a bit nervous and would stop. He would try and be consistent and say, well, look, I don't know that I'm going to fall. I can't absolutely prove that. It's just a hypothesis. So he had to have helpers to stop him from going over the edge, basically. Because anyone who lived that kind of scepticism wouldn't last very long. Mm-hmm. And that's the most extreme form of scepticism, where you take nothing at all for granted. It's something that, in some ways, René Descartes, in the 17th century, took up and actually applied in his meditations, where he started to think, you know, once in a lifetime I'm going to try and push that scepticism to the limit. And it's the theme that runs through most philosophy, this idea of challenging assumptions. But the ancient Greek Pyrrhonic scepticism, the scepticism that's attached to Pyrrho, is ridiculous. I mean, it's not livable. It's almost like an extreme case that allows us to realise that we have to move on from that. But questioning things that other people take for granted and things that we ourselves have taken for granted is, for me, the essence of philosophy. That's throughout this book. I'm talking about people who challenge dogmatism. These are people who were dissenters. They're people who just wouldn't accept something because an authority told them it was true. They needed to look at the reasons behind that position, and they were prepared to entertain the possibility that the orthodoxy was wrong. Mm-hmm. And that started with Socrates. For me, philosophy begins with Socrates asking really difficult questions. He saw himself as a gadfly, like a horsefly, stinging the great stallion of Athens into action and irritating it by his questioning. And, you know, he famously was described as the wisest man in Athens by the Delphic Oracle and wouldn't believe it because he felt he didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. But actually, he came to realize that knowing the limits of his own knowledge was true wisdom, and that many people around him were overly confident in the beliefs they'd inherited and the beliefs that they didn't question. And so he had this notion that the unexamined life isn't worth living for a human being, and was constantly questioning not just other people but himself, and wasn't prepared to carry on without doing that, and ended up, sadly, being executed by the state for various reasons, which I won't go into now. But, you know, so for me, that questioning, that scepticism, as it were, about what other people say is part of philosophy. But we have to recognise it comes to an end at a certain point if you want to live.
Mm-hmm. And we'll stick around. You brought up the idea of Socrates there, and it's interesting that, you know, the idea of philosopher has come to be seen as you know, a very sort of ascetic, very sort of intellectual person in an ivory tower thinking very hard. Back in the ancient world, a lot of them were basically just mad hobos who went around bothering people, weren't they?
Well, if you think about what's going on in California at the moment, a lot of people misjudge people by appearances. They think, you know, there are people who have occult figures who suddenly emerge with a major new development in technology that changes the whole nature of the world. I mean, we have to remember that even though Steve Jobs was essentially a businessman, this is a guy who spent a lot of time in India and dropped acid and all kinds of things. He would have been a hobo in many people's eyes. I don't think being a hobo precludes making significant contributions to humanity.
This is true.
You're listening to Little Atoms with our guest Nigel Warburton, and we're discussing a little history of philosophy. I'm thinking back to when I, you know, fairly unsuccessfully studied philosophy at university. And we tend to, what strikes me is we went straight from Greece to 18th century Germany with very little in between. What did I miss?
Well, there's a caricature of the history of philosophy which says you didn't miss anything, really, which suggests that the medieval schoolmen, as they were sometimes known, were just interpreters of Aristotle. Mm-hmm. Scholastic philosophy was about how many angels you can get on a pinhead, and really disappearing into a kind of fog of these minute distinctions that people are making that don't really matter, or else making all kinds of assumptions about the nature of God and then reasoning from that about things which possibly don't concern you now if you're not a religious believer. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some interesting texts. I mean, probably the most read text in the medieval period, Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy, is a fantastic book. It's got poetry and imaginative aspects to it. I mean, Boethius was actually imprisoned. He wrote it in prison, expecting to be tortured and about to die, possibly, which he did, in fact. And he imagines philosophy coming to him as this woman, this tall god, as it were, with the letters on her dress that signify the philosophical esoteric code, as it were. And so this is philosophy comes to him and said, why have you betrayed me? Why are you languishing in prison here, feeling sorry for yourself? Because true philosophy recognises that the wheel of fortune turns. You've been very successful, and now the wheel of fortune's turned, and you're not. This is just what life is like. But the philosopher should remain immune to the vicissitudes of external circumstances and be immersed in thought, and you can be responsible for how you feel about things. And there's a whole discussion about fate and the degree to which we can be masters of our destiny or mistresses of our destiny and so on. And if God knows what's going to happen, does that mean we have any free will at all? And it's a really interesting discussion, but it's actually framed in a literary way. And so I think that's a book that I would push people towards today and say that's a really interesting piece of literature that's worth reading, that raises philosophical questions in a charming way. But there are many other... I mean, I talk about St. Augustine talking about the problem of evil. There are famous arguments about the existence of God or non-existence of God that the medieval philosophers like Aquinas talked about at great length. And I do talk about some of those.
We should... perhaps there's... listeners of this radio show will know that we, you know, we have a certain attachment to the period of history called the Enlightenment. So we should perhaps talk about some of the philosophers associated with it. And you cover a lot of those people, from Voltaire through Hume, Kant and John Stuart Mill. So, well, perhaps we should look at... let's talk about Mill for a bit. You perhaps tell us a little bit about who he was and what he...
John Stuart Mill is one of my favourite philosophers. Really unusual man. He was... an experiment. His parents, well, his father, James Mill, with Jeremy Bentham, conduct an experiment on this young child because they believe that, following Locke to some extent, that a child is something of a blank slate on which experience writes things, and that given the right circumstances, almost any child could be taught to become a brilliant mathematician, a brilliant economist, a brilliant philosopher. And so they homeschooled John Stuart Mill. He was learning Latin and Greek from a very early age. I think he was learning Greek from age four, doing calculus at some very young age. And so he became this... he was actually a success in one sense because he did become a genius. He was one of the brightest individuals of his age in the 19th century. You know, by the age of 20, he knew a great deal of history. He'd read Plato in the original. And it wasn't just a passive style of learning. This was based on a kind of Socratic style of discussion with his father. So he'd read stuff and then go for long walks and be cross-questioned on what he'd been learning. And so it was a very dynamic kind of education. They were part of the utilitarian school of philosophy. This is the idea that the right action in any circumstance is the one which will maximise happiness. In Mill's form, it's also connected with this idea that it's not just the individual actions that are relevant, but the kinds of actions, the sort of rules which you could generate, which will produce the best possible circumstances. But for me, one of his most successful contributions is this amazing little book called On Liberty, which was published in 1859, in the same year as The Origin of Species was published. It's written for a popular audience, and it's got at its centre this idea of the harm principle, the idea that the limits of my behaviour, anything that I do, should be the point where I harm somebody else by my actions. That's a basic principle underlining the way he wants to organise society. He's talking about adults here. You can be paternalistic towards children, or maternalistic if you'd rather, act as a father figure, as it were, and protect them for their own good. But when you're dealing with adults, there's this great sort of liberal position, we should have this degree of autonomy where we make our own decisions about our lives, including making our own mistakes. We don't accept a life off the peg that somebody else wants to give us, because we know better than most other people what's likely to make our lives go well. And even if we're wrong, it's better that we make those choices for ourselves rather than be coerced into positions by other people. So he was opposed to this sort of top-down structuring of how people had to live, partly because he himself had been a kind of victim of the tyranny of the majority, as he called it, in various ways. Partly, presumably, for his non-belief, his agnosticism or possible atheism, but also because of a relationship he had with a married woman whom he finally married, and all the sort of assumptions that were being made about his relationship and so on. Then he felt the pressure of society, but he felt it's up to individuals how they live. And that's a way that will allow not just the individuals to flourish, but society to flourish. But there's a chapter in that book which is particularly poignant, the one on free speech, where he puts forward a number of ideas about why you should have extensive freedom of speech, the power of the dissenting voice, which is essentially the voice of the philosopher sometimes. He felt it was important that we have ideas that challenge us because, as he put it, both teachers and learners go to sleep at the post when there's no enemy in the field, If you don't have your views challenged, you hold them as what he called dead dogma. That's a kind of unchallenged belief that the unthinking person just, this is what I believe. For him, that's not the way that we should live. We should hold our beliefs as living beliefs, beliefs capable of motivating us to action, beliefs which have passed the test of being challenged by people who actually believe the opposite. So, you know, he defended extensive freedom of speech, partly because he thought through the collision of error and truth, this is our best method for getting at the truth, partly because he thought this will make people happier, but partly because this whole kind of cut and thrust of argument is going to give you living beliefs, things which will actually make you do stuff. You don't, if you just hold a belief, he felt it doesn't connect with your moral thinking in that direct way that a belief that has been challenged and shown to be the best available one. This is a really important point, that like Socrates, he had a combination of arrogance and humility. This is, mm-hmm. I think, characteristic of the best philosophy. The arrogance comes from the willingness to challenge, but the humility comes from the recognition that you might be wrong. And it's that weird combination that makes philosophers particularly irritating, I think.
Just the last couple of philosophers that we'll talk about, also, again, relevant to the subject matter of this programme, you include Karl Popper and Thomas Kuhn, who will be, again, familiar to our listeners. For Karl Popper came up with the idea of falsifiability, and Thomas Kuhn is probably most famous for the idea of the paradigm shift. So let's talk about perhaps why you included these two.
Well, I wanted to have a broad range of topics within the book, and the philosophy of science is incredibly important. I do actually include a chapter on Charles Darwin, perversely, seeing as I left Heidegger, and one on Freud. The reason why Popper's there with Kuhn is that I think his philosophy is both intelligible, allows me to explain also some of Hume's ideas about induction. For Popper, obviously, science doesn't move by people proving things, but by refuting them. So it's not a process of accumulating lots of little bits of information which then leads you to say, aha, that's the truth. The point is you come up with a hypothesis and then you attempt to refute that hypothesis. And it only takes one reliable observation, in a sense, to refute a generalisation. So there's a really interesting thought, and it's something that had a massive influence on scientists in the 50s and since. Many scientists do see their work entirely in Popperian light, that's actually what they're doing. They're finding bold hypotheses, which they then attempt to undermine by their experiments, rather than prove that those hypotheses are true directly. And of course, there's a Kuhnian, you know, Thomas Kuhn's challenge to that is that that's not actually an accurate description of the history of science. If you look at the history of science, it doesn't quite work like that. Mm-hmm. You have these large periods of time where people are doing what he calls normal science. They're working within a particular framework, like the pre-Copernican framework, and then you have what he calls a paradigm shift. And it's not usually produced by evidence working to change people's minds in a straightforward way. There are all kinds of social phenomena that cause that shift, so that the move from people thinking that the Earth is the centre of the solar system, not the solar system, but the centre of the cosmos, as they were, to the point where they see the Earth is going around the sun, there's a lot of things going on there that aren't about evidence. And yet when you've made that shift, then everybody makes that assumption and works within that framework. And it's almost impossible to discover evidence that refutes that. It's always taken to be a mistake, not actually a refutation of the particular position.
I like how you talk about those sort of social shifts, and it's often sort of commonly described as all the people that don't believe in the new idea dying off and being replaced by the ones that do. Okay, so we're sort of virtually out of time, but really quickly to finish up, I just want to talk about the design of the book for a little, and it's like a really beautiful artefact, and it does seem to be happening at the moment that people are suddenly caring again about what books look like, basically. I think
it's really interesting at this point where ebooks are starting to take off. I mean, there is a Kindle version of this book, and it does work okay because the black and white illustrations, woodcut style illustrations, actually translate to a Kindle, but many illustrated books won't work that way. I think there's this really fascinating point we've reached where you walk into a bookshop and it's now filled with beautiful covers, beautiful books, embossed covers. And I think we've started to react to electronic books by almost fetishizing the object, the book, And I'm very lucky that Yale have done a fantastic job on this. And it's, you know, I feel very proud to be the author of such a beautiful book.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Nigel Warburton's Little History of Philosophy is, as we just mentioned, published by Yale and available on Kindle. Thank you for joining us in Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.